walk away from me, yeah.
Hello, hello, and welcome again to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're also on the web at KUCI.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing. Today, my guests are Lisa Glatt and Adam Braver. First up is Lisa Glatt. Lisa is the author of the novel, A Girl Becomes a Comma Like That, and the short story collection, The Apples Bruise, both published by Simon & Schuster. Her poetry collections include Shelter and Monsters and Other Lovers. Lisa's work has appeared, or is forthcoming, in such magazines as Zoetrope, Mississippi Review, Columbia, Indiana Review, Pearl, and The Sun. She was recently awarded a fellowship to the Civitella Rainieri Center in Italy. Lisa teaches at California State University Long Beach and also runs private workshops. Hi, Lisa.
Hi.
Great to have you on the show. I'm hearing a little echo. Are you hearing it?
No. Okay. Maybe I'll move.
I don't hear it anymore. You've
I'll
moved.
I'll change positions if that might help.
No, it's great.
Okay.
I am so curious about your books in that you started with a novel, and your second collection is a collection of short stories, The mm-hmm. Apples Bruise. That usually it seems that writers go the other way around, beginning with short stories and then are somehow finagled into doing a novel, whether they want to or not.
Right. I was doing both. And I mean, I was actually doing it just the way that you described, which is I was writing stories. I was writing poetry and short fiction for many, many years. And then I started to write a series of stories that seemed to, without really trying to write a novel, I started to write these stories about the same characters. And that's where the Rachel and her mother, which is from A Girl Becomes a Comma Like That, that's when the stories started to be connected. I realized I was working on not a series of stories, but something that was longer, that was a longer book. But I was actually, had been working on short fiction for a really long time. And so that's probably the form that I, at this point, feel most comfortable doing. I feel most comfortable writing short stories. But when they link up and they start to form an arc on their own, they sort of tell you that that's what you're writing is a novel.
Interesting. So did anyone give you any trouble about going to short stories instead of a second novel?
No, I think that I wouldn't say they gave me trouble, but I would say that the people, the powers that be are interested certainly in another novel from me, which is, the state of short fiction. I think there's so much wonderful short fiction being written in this country, and I think that a lot of it, there's a lot of short fiction that's being published. I don't know that it's being promoted with the same energy that novels are promoted, or perhaps it is, what they tell us, which is that they're not being read. People don't want to read stories. I mean, I want to read stories. I have, new collections by my bed at any given time, five or six of them at a time, and I find it really hard to believe that people don't read more stories.
Yeah, it's, you wonder where the information is coming from.
Yeah.
I wanted to talk to you about voice, and I love to talk about voice with writers who have a very singular voice, because it seems to be one of the more esoteric aspects of writing, mm-hmm. where you can't create a false voice. Almost, voice is really an organic process. It comes out of who you are and your lifestyle and everything else. Your voice is so delightful. There's this dark streak, and there's all this humor happening.
I love to hear that, because sometimes people really just comment on the darkness, and I.
Oh my goodness.
That makes me really happy to hear that from you, Barbara.
No, your stories and your novel is just this wonderful humor running through it. Is that
that's great?
Is that just you? Is that are you funny?
I don't. You know, but. There are people like my father who would say, like, why aren't you funny in your fiction? You're so funny in life. You're not funny in your fiction. So you're not funny enough in your fiction, because there is, you know, there's always some kind of sadness or darkness going on. But I don't know. Some people might think that, say that I am funny. I certainly won't be funny for the next 20 minutes because of having said that. but some people would say that I was pretty funny, I think.
Yeah, I would think so. I remember at the L.A. Times Festival of Books, the panel you were on, there, I think I was there for the whole thing, but maybe not, and I don't remember you saying a whole lot, but you had the funniest facial expressions.
I did?
And I thought, she is one hilarious woman.
Oh, that's very nice. That's very, very nice. That was actually where they talked a lot. They asked questions about voice, and where some of the discussion was really interesting in that the... you know, all of us up there had different things to say, but I remember saying sort of that it's kind of like a an earned confidence, like you've been writing for a long time and you wake up on a good day, because I still can have a very bad day where I wake up and the voice isn't there, nothing's really there, and I'm just kind of typing away and miserable and can't wait to go dust the shelves or something. But until then, like when you're really having a good day, you sit down and you have this kind of confidence and this, like, I have this experience and this confidence and you know, you write with a certain sort of, there's a vigor and an energy, and that all that comes into the voice thing. Like, it sort of just happens, and you kind of know that you're having that kind of day when you're having it. But all that is, it's so voice related. It's so about just being confident and moving right along.
Interesting. You're listening to Writers on Writing. I am here today with Lisa Glatt, author of A Girl Becomes a Comma Like That and The Apples Bruise. Did voice happen for you pretty quick out of the gate? I mean, or is it something that you worked on, struggled with, tried to find?
You know, it's so horrible, because I think it's one of those things that the more you try to find, or the more you think you're working on it, the more that you think about anything, the further away from it you somehow get. It's almost like trying to be authentic, or trying to tell, you know, trying to love someone, or trying to do something too much, you know, often involves, you know, often leads you to failure. And so that sometimes it's when you just relax the right way. It's a very strange thing, because it's a mix of wanting to get to this place where your writing is authentic and real, and yet not trying to be real, because then it won't happen for you. So there's a whole lot of things that go into it. I think one of the things that really helped me was a lot of reading. Just, you know, I read everything, but mostly I read poetry and short fiction. And I think that really, you know, through listening to, through hearing everybody else's voice, I think I was able to stumble upon my own. And, you know, there comes in the beginning a certain amount of imitation, a certain amount of, God, I wish I sounded like, you know, Anne Sexton, or I wish I was this one, or I wish I was that one. And then all of a sudden you wake up one day and you're writing something, and it dawns on you that this, you know, that this time it's you, and that hopefully that, you know, that in some way is valuable or interesting to others, because that's like when it's really happening for you. So it wasn't a matter of trying to find it. It was a matter of reading and a matter of sitting myself down and doing the work and just sitting there, you know, day after day and writing towards something.
Mm-hmm. Well, in terms of reading, and I'm going to ask you this, because last night in my class, one of my students asked me this, and he said, because, you know, as writers, we read, and we read hopefully for a lot of reasons, and one of them is to become better writers. And he said, are you ever too influenced by what you read? And is it really a good thing to read?
It's such a good thing to read. It's such a, but always, I have students ask me that too, or like, there's a, the beginning of, like, when the first days of class at Cal State Long Beach, I give them this thing that's a questionnaire. It's my own little homemade questionnaire. And one of the things is, you know, if I want to write, I should read everything, you know, poetry, fiction, the newspaper. If I want to write, I should, and you have, like, it's a multiple choice. And one of them is, if I want to write, I should read nothing because it will spoil my genius. Mm. And I'm always so surprised at how many people pick that one and pick it very seriously. The truth is, I think that might happen if you only read one other writer. But I think that when you love reading, which is why the only reason that I could imagine wanting to be a writer, because there are so many reasons not to be one. But when you love reading and you read all sorts of writers and you find the ones that you love, I don't think it's a matter of so much of being influenced. It's just seeing how different sentences are put together, seeing how different, you know, themes are handled, you know, the big ones, love and death and all those, seeing things through different writers' perceptions, mm-hmm. and then sort of discovering your own. Because only when you discover your own will you really be onto anything.
Yes.
But I don't think you can read too much. In fact, I think if you're having a really bad writing day, that it's perfectly okay to, you know, curl up on the couch and read.
Mm-hmm.
And no doubt, whenever I do that, no doubt I jump up at some point, and it could just be a word, you know, or an image, and it just, like, it sets me going in a completely different direction than the writer was going, but in my own, and it's such a gift to have that, to have shelves with books on them.
Yes.
What did you tell your student?
Well, I said that I'm more influenced by bad writing, and so I try not to read something that I really don't think is very good, even if there's the topic or there's a writer.
Oh, that's great.
I want to read, but the good stuff, I'm not really influenced in a way that I can see, except that it prompts me to do better somehow.
That's great. I think that's great.
I don't know.
But, I think
but the bad
great.
Stuff, you know, I used to hear, oh, you can learn from anything, good writing, bad writing,
I don't
whatever.
Think so either.
It's like, no, I don't want to read the bad stuff.
Right. I don't need to put a bad sentence together because I can do that on a bad day myself.
Right.
Right. Right. You
mentioned your father earlier,
uh-huh.
and I'm thinking of your collection of short stories, The Apples Bruise. And I'm thinking of one story in particular that I mentioned to you in an email called Waste, which I thought was just a wonderful story. It was just so funny and dark. And I started thinking, when you mentioned your father, that a fear that new writers have, which is their parents or people close to them reading their stuff, and what are they going to think?
Right.
I take it you don't have that. Fear.
No, I have. I had my mother, Iris Fanton, who died of breast cancer in 1998, was the parent that I grew up in the house with, and they were divorced when I was very small. But my father remained close. We all remained close to each other. But my mother was Jewish, and she married. I had an Arab stepfather, and at some point they became nudists, and I think I was about 12. So it was a very progressive, let's say, household, and there was, like, not a lot of taboo subjects in terms of talking about things or, you know, reading things, or, you know, it was a very open household. And I think I read, this is embarrassing, but I think I read Fear of Flying, Erica Jong's Fear of Flying, when I was 13.
Uh-huh.
And that's pretty young. Like, a lot of people would think that that was, you know, not the book to be reading, but it was sitting right there next to Judy Blume. And so I had... You know, it was a whole range of things, but I was always interested from an early age in writing about the body, and then there were my, you know, my mother and my stepfather's naked bodies, and it became a thing for me, and I never felt censored, certainly by my mother, and then even by my father, I never felt that on his side either, and not that everything I wrote I showed them, I didn't, but my mom saw a lot of it. She saw a lot of the wilder things and the, you know, the early poems, and I never felt judged, or I never felt like there were things I couldn't say. Mm. And there were even, I was talking to my students on Sunday about that, because some of them feel, you know, they censor themselves before anyone can say, God, don't write that. They
yes.
censor themselves. They're doing that job, you know, for everyone else. And it's really a sad thing, I think, to worry about that before, you know, before things are even hitting the presses. You know, if you're worried about that then, even when you're sitting down and bringing it to, let's say, just a workshop or, you know, your very friendly writers group, or you should have none of those worries. You should either have a different writers group, or you have to find a way to not censor yourself. There were things that I wrote about early on that I wouldn't even talk about early on, but that I felt, for whatever reason, I don't know who gave me permission, but I felt very comfortable writing about them. And that's, I think that's really helpful when you're trying to find your subject matter, you're trying to find what it is that you want to say. The freer you are and the less you do that, you know, and your parents don't have to see it. They,
right.
You know, they don't have to see it.
Until it's published.
Until it's published. And then even when it's published, I have friends who are poets who have certain books that their parents see and other books that their parents don't see. I think maybe for novelists, or especially if they become popular novelists, it might be a little harder if they have parents that frequent bookstores or want to know what have they been doing all these years.
Yes,
but
yes.
I think there's a way around all of that. And the less you worry about it in the process, the better, I think.
Mm-hmm. Will you read to us?
I will read to you.
And if you just tuned in, you are listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. Lisa Glatt is about to read from her collection of short stories, The Apples Bruise.
This is the first story in the collection, and I'm going to read a small section of it at the beginning, and it's called Dirty Hannah Gets Hit by a Car.
Okay.
Hannah lives in a Southern California beach city without sidewalks, with lawns and flower beds that go right down to the curbs. And today, because it is Monday, trash day, those curbs are lined with fat green bags and reeking metal bins. And today, because her parents are fighting, she will walk across the street, stand on Erica Huff's porch, and knock on the front door. And today, because Erica is sick, Hannah will walk to school alone. Erica is 2 years older than Hannah and only talks to her when no one's looking. She's more doll than girl, Hannah's decided, with her huge gray eyes that rarely seem to blink. Her hair is long and blonde and shiny. It swishes when she walks. Hannah's dark, tight curls do not swish. On mornings just like this morning, Hannah has stood on the Huff's porch waiting, staring down at the welcome mat with her bagged lunch knocking at her hip, overhearing Erica's protests. Not again, forget it, I won't touch her, we look like lezzies. And she has heard Mrs. Huff groan and beg, please, Erica, please, honey. And Erica responding with, no, 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 and then the words that echo down the foyer, she's dirty, Mom. I won't hold her hand. Not so loud, Erica. The poor girl will hear you, Mrs. Huff scolds. She's dirty, Erica insists. Always, Mrs. Huff says then, the girl is all alone in the world. Or maybe she says, all along in the world. But either way, Hannah knows from the woman's tone that all along or all alone makes her a girl to be pitied. She has glanced at her plastic watch and feared Mr. Henderson's reprimand about being tardy, imagined him bending down, face inches from her face, saying, Hannah Teller, you're late again, Hannah Teller. She has peered through the crack in the front door and into the kitchen where Mrs. Huff stands with a hand on her hip, sighing loud enough for Hannah to hear. She's watched the woman move out of the room, out of her view, and return within seconds, clutching her red purse under her arm. She smacks the purse down on the counter, unzips it, and pulls out her wallet, saying, I'll pay you. You happy now? Feel good about yourself? What kind of a girl are you? Erica shrugs and sneers. Even from the doorway, Hannah has seen her shoulders rising, her lips twisting. Mrs. Huff snaps open the wallet then, and the green bills move from her hand into her daughter's waiting palm. You're a Christian girl, she says. You should behave that way. Soon, Erica joins Hannah on the porch and defiantly snatches her hand, muttering under her breath, almost dragging her down the driveway. And Mrs. Huff shouts after the two of them, be nice, girls. Be good girls. When they get halfway down the block and out of Mrs. Huff's view, Erica drops her hand and wipes off her own, slapping her palm against her skirt or jeans as if whatever makes Hannah awkward and unpopular might very well be contagious. Today, though, Erica is the one who's contagious, sick with red blisters on her face and body that Mrs. Huff describes to Hannah in theatrical detail. There's one the size of a pancake covering her belly, she says, and four shaped like almonds on her face. It's the strangest thing. They go like this. And Mrs. Huff uses a manicured nail to sketch a perfect C on her own cheek. Oh, Hannah says quietly. And she won't stop scratching, she continues. You know, Erica, she does what she wants. It's what she wants or it's nothing at all. She's like her father that way. When she was little, she wouldn't even eat ice cream. Imagine that. Hannah's nervous, biting her bottom lip. Anyway, now she's making herself bleed. The sores are oozing, the rash spreading. It's terrible. Sounds bad, Hannah says. The doctor says it's not chicken pox and there are not any hives he recognizes. What do we pay him for? Hannah looks at her blankly. You know, Erica, she says. You know it's her way or the highway. If she's going to scratch, she's going to scratch. You know, Erica, she says again. I guess, Hannah says quietly.
Oh, thank you. Ah, what a story. That was Lisa Glatt reading from The Apple's Bruise, the first story, Dirty Hannah Gets Hit by a Car. Where did that story come from?
That story, of all the stories in the book, actually is probably the most autobiographical, in that when I was 6 years old, I lived in Manhattan Beach, and I was hit by a car on the way to school. And but that's, you know, and I did have an abscessed liver and a splenectomy, and sort of the problems that Hannah has, the physical problems that she has after the car accident. Unlike Hannah, I didn't have a bully across the street, but I realized that while I was writing the story, that the character Erica appeared, and that I realized that without the bully, I didn't really have a story, that it's not enough to just sort of recount an event that sort of happened to you without finding the bully in it. So that's where that one came from.
Yeah. Well, these are just wonderful stories, and gosh, great work. I wanted to ask you real quick, because we only have a couple of minutes left, what the process was for you in finding an agent. Was it an easy time, and then did your work sell pretty quickly?
But you know, finding an agent has never really been a problem for me. I think. You know, I've heard it all different sorts of ways, that people have trouble finding agents, or they find the agents easily and then they have trouble, you know, that selling isn't so easy, or some people have really, you know, very smooth and fast stories, and those are the stories that all the new writers want to hear about. But I had an agent for a while, and then I have an agent now that I found because the agent that I had wasn't such a good fit, and I was looking through a collection of stories and a collection of stories by a writer named Jason Brown, who I admire very much, who I believe is up in San Francisco. He wrote a book of stories called Driving the Heart, and my husband actually, we both were reading that book, and my husband looked and said, look, his agent is Andrew Blauner, and so we contacted Andrew, and I'd had several things published by then, so it wasn't as hard to get an agent. And Andrew, you know, called me, and I signed with him very soon after that. But I think that sometimes people might be looking for an agent early. Like, I had been writing for so many years and publishing on my own and doing quite a bit that I didn't have a hard time finding an agent.
Mm. So, well, I wish we had more time. Any advice for the writers who are listening?
The writers who are listening?
Yeah, the writers.
You know, Bernard Cooper said this before I did, and he's a wonderful writer in Los Angeles, but he said, get ready for a long apprenticeship.
Yes.
And no one wants to hear that, but that's really true. So get ready for a long apprenticeship and sit down and do the work and find out whether you want to be a writer, or you make sure that what you really want to be is a writer, which involves like doing the writing and not romanticizing the idea of it. Because sometimes the idea of it is much more romantic and exciting than the actual, like, sitting there day after day in your pajamas.
Right. It's that thing of, I want to have written.
I want to have written, exactly. Exactly. And I wish I'd written today. But I understand that completely.
Well, you've been a delight, and I wish you continued luck on your work. You get wonderful reviews, and people say wonderful things. So
oh, thank
it's,
you so much, Barbara. You have a great thing going on here, and it was lovely to talk to you.
Thank you.
And your students are lucky.
Thank you, and yours too.
Thank you.
That was Lisa Glatt, author of The Apples Bruise and A Girl Becomes a Comma Like That. You can visit her website at lisaglatt.com. That's L-I-S-A-G-L-A-T-T. Stay tuned. We'll be right back with more Writers on Writing.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama, aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child. Seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time. One built in a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're also on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and the opinions and views that you hear on this show are those of me and my guests and not those of the University of California, Irvine Regents. Oh, it's good to be back after that short break, and we were with Lisa Glatt during the first half of the show, and we are back with Adam Braver. Adam Braver's first book, Mr. Lincoln's Wars, was a Barnes & Noble Discover Great New Writers pick, a Borders Original Voices selection, a Book Sense 76 pick, and appeared on the San Francisco Chronicle's bestseller list, among many other year-end lists. He received his MFA from Goddard College in Vermont. He's on faculty at the Creative Writing Program at Roger Williams University in Bristol, Rhode Island, where he lives with his wife and son. And his latest book, Divine Sarah, was recently released in paperback. Hi, Adam.
Hi, Barbara.
Great to have you on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Will you talk a little bit about how Divine Sarah came about?
Sure. It was originally meant to be a second part of the Mr. Lincoln's Wars, and I mean that, I guess, not quite so literally. But I had been very much engaged in this thematic idea of public life versus private life and how those two worlds collide. And when I finished it, I wanted to look at somebody else who, other than Lincoln, who was the character in the first book. And Sarah Bernhardt just was brought to my attention. I mean, I had this discussion with a lot of people who said, and finally somebody said, have you thought about Sarah Bernhardt? And I did some. And I thought about it, And that's where and it started to evolve out of that, but really out of trying to work out some thematic issues that felt unresolved to me after the first book. Of course, it opened up a whole new box of ideas for me.
It's interesting, the idea of taking a historical figure or celebrity and creating a novel around them. Had you at all considered doing something, narrative nonfiction piece with her, or was it a novel from the start?
It was a novel from the start. I think my background is in fiction writing, so I'm not sure that I would quite know how to actually do a narrative piece, because mm-hmm. I would undoubtedly start making stuff up at some point. but
you must be just involved in history or interested in history. So taking something, someone real, and then fictionalizing.
Yeah, you know, when the Lincoln book came out, I can very clearly remember one of the first readings I did, and a woman raised her hand, and she said, "What gives you the audacity to write fiction about Abraham Lincoln?" But I'm not sure it was audacity more than naivete. But part of the lure for both of these people to me was that they were, in very different ways, huge mythical figures of their time, and of course Lincoln still is. But we're still very enigmatic in that there's really so little known about their private moments. So for me that became a factor for exploration. And that's what I was more interested, I guess, is in these, you know, both those two books deal with what I hoped was sort of a defining emotional moment, and trying to understand that.
Interesting. You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Adam Braver, author of Divine Sarah, a novel. I'm curious, are the words a novel on the book to make it clear to people wandering bookstores that it is a novel?
Oh, you mean, is that why they're purposely on the cover?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know.
I mean, you know, I suppose you could go, this is a biography on Sarah Bernhardt, or I don't know what, you know, obviously if it were in the fiction section, you're not going to think that if you're paying any attention to what section of the store you're in.
Sure. But, although, I had several people who wrote to me somewhat disappointed after the Lincoln book that said that after I read this, I realized that it was a novel, which, you know, I can't take responsibility for that. That book set a novel in 13 stories, so it sort of drove the point home. But it was interesting because that book, the working title was actually The Wars of Lincoln, and we had decided that sounded too much like a textbook.
Mm-hmm.
I think there was some concern for it. I mean, not so much on my end, but in terms of from the publishing end.
Yeah,
but I'm not sure if that's why they put a novel on there, or if that's just what they do.
Yeah, just what they do. Who knows what they do? So I'm wondering, had you been? I mean, how you? You know, where? What am I trying to say? Where the starting point was for Divine Sarah? Was it long, long ago that you were into Sarah Bernhardt, or found her a fascinating, you know, creature, or how did it begin? I mean, where was the genesis?
Well, the genesis really was out of these conversations after the Lincoln book of me thinking that I hadn't really explored deep enough what I wanted to explore, and that maybe if I wrote about one or two other people, I originally imagined this as a trilogy, of which it's sort of died on the vine for that. But I had been thinking about, who else could I write about that's sort of mythical, sort of enigmatic, who is far away from Lincoln as possible, but might be able to also, if that person and Lincoln could be in a room together, might understand what it was like to be each other. So Sarah Bernhardt, I really didn't know that much about her when I started getting involved in this, other than that she was somewhat legendary for her, you know, for these various antics and being controversial and so forth. As I did more research, I found a lot of interesting things about her, although I can't say I knew how to frame a story around it, a narrative. And then I finally came across something from the Venice Beach Historical Society, which was a little blurb on their website about her being boycotted out of Los Angeles in 1906 by the League of Decency, and being stuck to and essentially being stuck in ocean at the time Ocean Beach, but in Venice, performing out there. Which, and she was in her early 60s at this point.
Yes,
and to me there seemed like a narrative in there of just being boycotted from a somewhat powerful conservative right-wing religious group. And I know we're not, this is not reflecting the views of the UCI region. and on top of that, being having to perform in Venice Beach.
Right.
Which at that point was really about Ferris wheels and jugglers and carnival stuff. So for me, that's when the story started to take off to me about what that would have meant to someone of her magnitude. And she really was a huge superstar, an international superstar in her day, of being stuck at that juncture of her career, and really wondering if maybe that's a sign to give it up, which then took me into this whole other thematic region of an artist's relationship to her art, and can, is it something that she can just really give up, or is it, or, you know, questions of identity and so on.
Yeah, interesting. You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Adam Braver, author of Divine Sarah. So you picked a week. You picked a week in her life.
I did pick a week. Yeah.
And why that week? Because of sort of being at a certain crossroads, or what was it about?
It seemed to me that it was a week that, I mean, I'm always interested when I write, whether it's a short story or, you know, a novel, I'm always interested, and I think I'm interested as a reader as well, a certain moment that defines a life. One in which that moment can tell you not only about the person and who they are from the way they behave in that moment, but also reflects on where they've been as well, for you know, for being able to jump back into the past and so on. So for me, that seemed as though it was certainly an interesting moment to you know, consider anyway, that it would tell a lot about her, and how she saw herself in the past, how she saw herself presently, and how she envisioned her future, all within this one week. You know, I will say, in some, I guess, full disclosure, that other than the Venice Beach Historical Society's website, I have not seen this story pop up. Other than, I mean, I know she played in Los Angeles, I know she played in Venice, but sort of this whole notion of a boycott and stuff is, you know, it doesn't show up in biographies, so it certainly is not a monumental moment.
Yes,
in the history of her life. But I imagine psychologically, and I guess I could imagine, just like with Lincoln, and that book is centered around the time when his son died while he was in the White House. I mean, I just couldn't imagine how it wouldn't be, how it wouldn't play with her mind,
right?
And how she couldn't question it, because while she sort of had this outward hubris, I can't imagine that inward there wasn't some fragility.
Interesting. You know, I think it's interesting because you could, or a writer could, deal with this subject matter or this person of Sarah Bernhardt and write a historical novel, and yet yours is so not what I would consider historical fiction. And I think it has very much to do with the style, the literary style and voice. And I wonder if that was at all a concern of yours, that it not be, you know, people not think of it as historical fiction, or do you just not even think of that sort of thing when you're dealing with something out of history?
I can't say it was conscious. I mean, only in that I was conscious of wanting to write a contemporary book, meaning not one that tried to capture the rhythms and I didn't want to write a book that sounded like it was written in the 19th century or early 20th century. It really came to play more with the first book, with the Lincoln book, because that book is also written in a very contemporary style and contemporary rhythms and, even consciously some anachronisms and so on. Mostly because I wanted to, I guess what I was trying to get with these is to make them feel immediate and not feel as though they're telling a moment of history,
but
to make them feel as alive as anything else, which is for some people difficult. I think, you know, when I talk to some people who've read the books, who have an expectation of sort of a standard historical fiction, which is, you know, almost a biography,
mm-hmm.
except with a sort of an omniscient narrator describing scenes and so on. But I really wanted it to feel like it was now, and have more of, I guess, take the timelessness out of it. I think somewhere on the lines, I used to say I wanted to not make things feel, take the sepia tone off it and make it feel more alive.
Sure. I would imagine, well, the process of finding the voice for the book, what was that like? And did it just come to you? Did you just start writing the way you write and there it was?
I have to say that it was a little bit of a challenge to get into it. I was so hooked into this idea of a trilogy for a while that I immediately started writing it like the first book. And I probably started it a little too soon initially because I still had the form and so on. I originally was going to write in all these multiple voices, and which didn't really come to fruition. But I just kept writing finally. I mean, I just figured out I was going to write it as a regular narrative novel. And I can remember showing my editor, you know, an early draft, and he said, you know, I really like it. He said the problem is that it starts on page 90, and which I was, you know, mortified, of course, when I heard. But when I looked back at it, I realized that mostly what he meant was that not necessarily the story started, but that's when the voice started,
mm-hmm.
and from there, you know, it just took a lot of writing to just kind of find it and get into it, and at which point, you know, it took off there, and most of the book sort of that is published now pretty much is what started on page 90, and then, you know, I rewrote the beginning a little bit.
Interesting. Don't you love that? Yeah. Forget about the first 89 pages.
Right, I know. Yeah, easy for you to say. Huh?
Will you read to us?
Sure.
And if you just tuned in, as I say at this point, you're a little bit late, but we still have a few minutes with Adam Braver, author of Divine Sarah. He's about to read to us.
Okay, I'll read you just a short little passage that takes place. This is when she's in Venice Beach, and one of her quirks was that the Vanderbilts had a railway car that they had furnished for her that they shipped around to all her venues that she lived in or slept in, and she actually slept in one of the pretty close to the old railroad tracks by the Venice Pier. So this is a little scene inside that.
Okay.
It was dark inside the rail car. The plush black curtains, faded velvet stained purplish by dust streaks, were pulled tight, allowing only a sliver of light to slice through the part in the middle, leaving a dirty darkness. The 25-by-10-foot container smelled like it had been locked up tight for the past 3 days, which it had. The normally nondescript smells that flavored the essence of the furnishings emanated their own brand of staleness when left alone. The scent of inertia bled from lack of breath in the cluttered single room. Max, her manager, once referred to it as an abandoned whorehouse, and another time as a gypsy fortune teller's lair. A long, wide bed blocked off the back, fluffed up by a rumpled comforter with red, random brown stains that splattered out like haphazard sun rays, and bordered by a heap of threadbare pillows covered in what once had been the finest spun cotton. Sitting above the couch was the press photo of her taken in her infamous coffin some years back, placed perfectly so that it reflected in the center of the mirror. Her eyes seductively closed, arms crossed, and her lips drawn apart, partly in defiant and partly in childish restraint, under the light of a single candle, while near the bottom of the casket was the inscription Quand Mem, the reminder that she had fought against all odds. She loved that picture most. How her initial attraction had been to its smugness and defiance, how in a tug-in-cheek manner she'd managed to poo-poo the mores of the lingering reactionary class that fought tooth and nail to preserve the values of what they alone claimed as a stranglehold on decency. They perceived all change as a threat, and especially art that challenged thought, as opposed to merely memorializing. And as though insurgencies such as the French Revolution had never happened, these conservative moles turned their tiny little voices into megaphone thunder, declaring with undying conviction what was right for the rest of the world, vocalized by currency and the politicians they owned. Then imagine being a woman who challenges them, one who does not fear her femininity and actually bends and mutates it into hundreds of different forms that dare the country and then dare the world to think and reconsider. And sometimes it doesn't matter that she has to take a man's form or adopt a whore's body or lash with a revolutionary's tongue, because that is her calling. I'll stop there. Mm,
thank you so much. That was Adam Braver reading from Divine Sarah.
And as I read that, I realized it did sound like narrative nonfiction.
Oh, it didn't to me. It didn't to me because of the voice. Well, not. I mean, narrative nonfiction can have... often there's a, literary voice and all that, but it sounded like fiction. I don't know. I don't know why.
That whole thing is very interesting. I was just recently at a doing a writing, faculty thing up at a workshop up in Saratoga Springs, and it was a big discussion over dinners with the other writers is what that line is now between nonfiction and fiction, as it seems to get blurred more and more and more.
Mm-hmm.
And how those genres, whether they are in fact distinct genres anymore.
Right. Well, what do you do with research? And at what point? I mean, I suppose with someone who is long gone, you have a lot of leeway in terms of fictionalizing and embellishing.
Right.
But is that a concern? And where? Yeah, it does bring to mind. Where is the line?
Yeah, it was, my basic philosophy, my approach is, what really matters is the pages of the book, hopefully that's the only world that matters, although on some level there's common knowledge that you can't ignore, otherwise it becomes sort of science fiction.
Right.
But as long as I think it feels real within the pages, I certainly don't, and even with the book on Lincoln, which was even a little bit trickier because there's much more out there in the public domain, or public consciousness even about Lincoln. But really my allegiance was always to the story and not to the history. And hopefully they meet up at times. I had a few friends that were concerned because it took them several months to realize I was not writing about Sandra Bernhardt. and they were very concerned that I was going to get sued and all these kinds of things.
Oh, that's funny.
With this it's a little trickier because you're dealing with real people. But even when I teach or read stories of, just people, friends and stuff, I a lot of people have that problem just when they're basing things off family histories and everything else of not being sure how to straddle that allegiance between what they know to have been true and what the story calls for, and what the logic of the story needs.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we have a few minutes left, and I'm with Adam Braver, author of Divine Sarah. You teach, and I am wondering, of course your answer is going to be, of course you can, but the question is, can you teach writing? And how do you teach writing?
It's a tricky question, and partly because I have my salary locked up into this question, but I think that what you can do, I think you can guide with writing.
Mm-hmm.
I think that you can teach people how to hopefully teach people how to recognize what works and what doesn't work. For me, it all comes back to reading, and I have in my classes, I have students read as much, if not more. I mean, sir, I should have them read much more than they write. Over a course of a semester, they may only write one or two short stories and read, the equivalent of six or seven novels,
mm-hmm.
or collections of short stories, and so on. Because I think that's really how you learn to write, is by seeing how other people have done it, trying to figure out how they see how they've done it, try to figure out the ways they did it, and try to recognize and try to mimic that, or try to use the so-called master's solutions to the problematic parts of your pieces.
Mm-hmm.
My biggest challenge is one, getting people to be interested in work other than their own, and also getting people to slow down and reflect on what they've written.
Mm-hmm.
I think revision is certainly something, especially in a somewhat formal setting, that is very very much can be addressed in strategies for revision and ways that you, again, comes back to the idea of recognizing, I think training yourself to recognize. And I think people do have some instinct of it. You know, usually when you call somebody on something, it's not unusual that somebody will say, yeah, I kind of thought I was getting away with something there. I kind of thought that wasn't working.
Mm-hmm. How does teaching affect your own writing?
For the most part, I think it's positive in that it keeps me engaged on a level of basic craft that I would probably not think about as much.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of it is instinctual now. I mean, I in the same way that, tying my shoes, or, I don't think about how to knot my shoes anymore. Or shift a car, or these kinds of things. So it keeps me constantly engaged in that. It forces me also to I don't have a problem reading, but it forces me to talk about what I'm reading in a way that I would normally probably just internalize.
Sure.
I have to be careful to not let the stuff I'm reading creep into my consciousness too much for all kinds of reasons. But it's good. It keeps me engaged. I mean, for a number of years, I didn't teach. Mostly because I took the jobs I could get, but also because I like the idea of not intermingling my two lives.
Mm-hmm.
I spent a lot of years doing copywriting and these kinds of things, and
sure.
and really the last thing I wanted to do when I got home was write again.
Mm-hmm.
But they seem to inform each other well. I mean, it's been a good match for me, other than just the obvious issues of, carving time out and these kinds of things. But that's true in anybody's life.
Yeah. Well, we're at the end of our time, and I wonder if you would give the writers listening a wonderful piece of advice for them to keep going.
Okay.
A pearl, if you would.
Okay, a pearl. Uh-oh. Well, one thing that somebody told me, which stuck with me, and this is not really a craft issue, but more a morale issue.
Yes.
Is is just simple mule-headedness. and that is to just, that I think it's really easy to become discouraged when you're writing. I think one is it's really easy to become overly confident when you're writing, and is equally easy to become very discouraged, especially for writers who haven't been published and have been trying for a number of years. And I think I think you just have to stick with it and to keep doing it and keep and realizing that you get better every time you write something new.
Yes.
And the other thing is revising. I mean, I just I find people often being surprised when I tell them, for example, this new book that I'm hopefully done with is on its 18th draft, and that's just not unusual.
Mm-hmm.
And which is what makes writing also at times very boring and laborious, but that work eventually pays off.
Yes. Well, I do appreciate you coming on, and you've gotten some wonderful reviews for this book. Carolyn C. gave you a wonderful review on the Washington Post, I thought.
She did. She was very kind.
Just, gosh, I mean, she can be just so...
Yeah.
I love her. I she's been on the show a few times, and I think she's great, but I always sort of hold my breath when I start reading one of her reviews to see which way it's going to go, you know. But thank you so much, and I hope you'll come back on when your next book comes out.
I'd love to.
That'd be great. Thank you.
Thanks, Barbara.
Uh-huh.
Bye-bye.
That was Adam Braver, author of Divine Sarah, and he does have a website. I believe it's simply adambraver.com, where you can just find out more about him and his work. And he really went to extremes here to get on the show, because he's touring and traveling and doing all kinds of stuff. So I really appreciate it. And if you get a chance, go somewhere where he's talking and signing and being, and you'll have a great time. If you want to know more about Writers on Writing, you can go to my website, which is penonfire.com. You can email me from there if you want to be on my weekly email list. You can read about my book, Pen on Fire. And there's some events coming up here in L.A., Orange County, around the book, and different book fairs going on, and you can find all that there. And I'm going to leave you with a quote by Rilke, who said, "Be patient with all that is unsolved in your heart. Try to love the questions themselves, like locked rooms or like books that are written in a foreign tongue. Live the questions raw." Thanks for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. I am Barbara DeMarco still, and I hope to be next week as well. See you here then. Bye-bye.